Hi, you're listening to Femme AM, Concordia's only feminist radio show, on CJLO 6090 AM. I'm Megan, and I'm here with some other members of the CJLO Women's Plus Collective. Today we will be talking about the structural and systemic racism that we believe exists in Canada's treatment of Indigenous people. We will discuss the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls Inquiry, the hearings that took place in Montreal last week, as well as the Tina Fontaine and Colton Bushi cases. First of all, I would like to say that a lot of our episodes on Femme AM consist of research material punctuated by our own personal anecdotes. This episode is going to be a little bit different. Although all the material presented today was carefully researched by members of the CJLO Women's Collective, you won't be hearing as many personal stories. We would like to acknowledge that although we did interview Indigenous women for this episode, and you will hear their voices later, none of us are ourselves Indigenous. That being said, we are women, we are Canadians, and we care about understanding our country's complicated, violent, oppressive history and trying to effect positive change in the future. The mistreatment of Indigenous people, the missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls epidemic, and the injustices we saw play out in the murders of Colton Bushi and Tina Fontaine have led us to feel that this is a topic which it is crucial we address at this time. We would like to acknowledge that racism still exists within our institutions, including our universities, and is an ideology that continues to serve the purpose of keeping Indigenous people oppressed. The term ally has been criticized by some for its passive character, so we would like to explain our role as allies and accomplices, working alongside the Indigenous community to fight racism and oppression. Speaking from a place within the university, we want to find ways to leverage resources and material support and draw attention to the ways that even the institutions of which we are a part participate in the systemic oppression of minorities. We want to acknowledge our colonial history, and we believe this is a time to listen and learn. Our goal in this episode is not to speak on anyone else's behalf, but to provide information and resources with the intention of finding ways to make better listeners of us all. Now, Cassie is going to share some data on missing and murdered Indigenous women.
So hi, thanks Megan. So in the last 8 years, more data has been made public about missing and murdered Indigenous women. And so what I'm about to share is from 2010, and it is the most recent I could find in terms of gathering this many statistics. And as we know, like, the missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls has been described as a Canada's national crisis. And the estimates from the 1970s is still uncertain, but it's said to be approximately 1,000 to 4,000 women. So to give more background and why we call it a national crisis, like I said, I want to explore a fact sheet. And so the fact sheet we're going to look at is the Native Women Associations of Canada's fact sheet. It was released in 2010, but it gives historical context on how deep the crisis runs in Canada. As we move through the years, as I'm going to share some more stats into 2015 and then talk a bit about 2017, we'll see that the stats have barely moved. If anything, the numbers, as more data is collected and revealed, grow. Mm-hmm. So in 2010, NWAC approximated 582 cases of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. So of these, 67% were murder cases. 20% are cases of missing women or girls. 4% of cases are suspicious death. And that means the deaths regarded as like natural or accidental by the police, but still considered suspicious by the family or community members. 9% of the cases the cause is unknown. So it's unclear whether the woman was murdered, is still missing, or died in suspicious circumstances. So between their research, it showed that between 2000 and 2008, Indigenous women and girls represented approximately 10% of all female homicides in Canada. So in 2010, Indigenous women only made up 3% of the female population. In 2011, they made up 4% of the total female population. So 10% of Canada's total population in 2010 were missing and murdered Indigenous women. So 55% of the cases, as reported, were women under 31, and 88% of them were mothers. So the NWAC estimated that of the 88%, more than 440 Indigenous children were impacted from those deaths or the missing women. They also reported that Indigenous women are 3 times more likely to be killed by a stranger than a non-Indigenous woman are. So the fact sheet highlighted a key issue, which we're still discussing today in 2018, eight years later, is that there's no national database to track missing persons. And so separating the cases of Indigenous women from non-Indigenous women has been proven to be very difficult. And that's something we hear in the National Inquiry. They also mentioned the majority of the cases were in Western Canada. So I got kind of curious, okay, so what does that mean? So I looked at the Saskatchewan Police report, which was posted in 2017, which goes back to 1940. So from 1940 to 2017, 56% of missing people in Saskatchewan are Indigenous people. 2% were visible minorities and 68% were Caucasian. So it should be noted that in 2016, the Stats Can fact sheet reported that Saskatchewan's Indigenous population was only 16.3%. Hmm. So it's quite a jump there.
Yeah, no kidding.
So as we move forward to like 2011, when we have the Highway of Tears, which has been a subject of many documentaries, many conversations, you know, it's something that I think is a very emotional conversation, especially within Western Canada. So a bit of background, it's about the Highway of Tears is a series of murders and disappearances of mainly Indigenous women along the section Highway of 16 between Prince George and Prince Rupert, British Columbia, Canada. And the murders happened from 1969 until 2011. So the reason why they say that these murders happen between the areas is because there is no public transport between Prince George and Prince Rupert. And so a lot of the women were hitchhiking, or a lot of the people who were murdered were hitchhiking. And so of the 19 victims that they have like cases for, most of them were murdered and missing Indigenous women, but the community says that it likely ranges into the 40s. So there are cases that are still not reported, have not come forward. They're not looking, mm-hmm. not that they're not looking to resolve. They just haven't been resolved.
Right.
Of the 19, 13 were teenagers, which is, it's hard. A lot of the murders, if we look in the history, we do our research, are reported or attached to serial killers or rapists, but many of them are still unresolved. I thought this was really interesting. In 2015, when we're talking about not having enough data, we're saying, you know, there's not enough information. We're hearing in the National Inquiry, like, you know, we just need more of that. We need more stats. We need more proof. In 2015, the BC government deleted a series of emails about the Highway of Tears. So on October 22nd, 2015, Elizabeth Dunham, the Information and Privacy Commissioner of British Columbia, published a 65 report outlining how the BC government official had triple deleted emails relating to the Highway of Tears.
Wow.
Yeah. So in her report called Access Denied, Denham describes the act of triple deleting as transferring an email to the deleted folder on a computer system, deleting the email from the folder, and then overriding the backup that emits the system to retrieve deleted items. So considering the email deletion, you have to wonder what other information has been deleted.
Yeah, absolutely.
So as of 2017, there's still no way to tell how many Indigenous women and girls go missing in Canada each year. And even after the National Inquiry, which was $53.8 million, they still don't have a database. They still don't have an idea of how they're going to approach it. More is being revealed. Police are starting to gather the ethnicity on reporting. But it's a national crisis. And as we can see from the historical data, it's almost as if data has been hidden.
Yeah, definitely. No. Yeah, so in response to these shocking statistics and, well, in some case, lack of statistics, there has been an ongoing national inquiry of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, which recently held community hearings in Montreal here last week. So now we turn to Allison, who will discuss the background of the inquiry and what happened here last week.
Thank you, Megan. So, yeah, like you said, the inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls reached Montreal just last week. It took place from March 12th to the 16th at Hotel Bonaventure. And more than 70 people shared their stories in both public and private hearings. Now, before I get into the specifics of Montreal's inquiry, I want to provide some context, like what exactly is the inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, and why is it happening? So as Cassie said before, Indigenous women and girls make up 4% of Canada's population. However, they represent 16% of all female homicides between 1980 and 2012. Now, according to statistics from 2011, Indigenous women and girls are 7 times more likely to be a victim of homicide. Putting an exact number on how many Indigenous women and girls have been murdered or missing is unclear, however, you know, as Cassie was saying. So in response to calls for action from Indigenous families, communities, and organizations, the Government of Canada launched an independent national inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls in September of 2016. Before the launch, the government held meetings across Canada with survivors, family members, loved ones, as well as national Indigenous and frontline organizations in order to seek their input on the design and scope of the inquiry. From there, 5 commissioners were appointed to oversee the process, with Marion Buller as chief commissioner. It's important to note that the inquiry was established as independent from the Government of Canada, so no interference from federal, provincial, and territorial governments and Crown corporations. The mandate is to examine and report on the systemic causes of all forms of violence against Indigenous women and girls in Canada by observing the patterns and looking at the underlying factors. From the beginning, the commissioners have stated that the heart of the inquiry is the emotional well-being of the families who have lost a loved one. So they want to hear the stories. Prior to the hearings, the National Inquiry invited family members, loved ones, and survivors to reach out and identify themselves. In doing so, they ask these people to share details about the loved ones that they lost so they can understand, you know, who she is. They want to know her strengths, her gifts, her challenges that she faced, whether or not she was a mother, their favorite memories or stories about her, and how the loved one's memory can be honored through the inquiry. So the first hearings began in Whitehorse in Yukon over 3 days in May of 2017. And since then, hearings have taken place in Smithers, BC, Winnipeg, Edmonton, Saskatoon, Thunder Bay, all across Canada. And most recently, here in Montreal. Currently, the inquiry is taking place in Thompson, Manitoba. So there have been setbacks to the inquiry, however. After the first hearing, observers complained about the inquiry's terms of reference, the composition and administration, and also their perceived lack of transparency. In July of last year, the Assembly of First Nations asked the federal government to reset the inquiry, revisit the mandate, and also to extend the timeline. They argue that the inquiry is too focused on hearing from families and survivors rather than supplying concrete solutions. They also have a concern that the inquiry has not done enough to study the conduct of police and institutional racism. Also, throughout 2017, many key staff members left, including the executive director, the director of community relations, the lead lawyer and research director, and one of the commissioners, Marilyn Pourtois. Also, I want to quickly mention that there is another inquiry happening in Quebec currently, like the Vienne's Commission. This commission is tasked with looking specifically into the Quebec government's treatment of Indigenous people. According to Michelle Audette, one of the National Inquiry's commissioners, the two are complementary, but they're not comparable. The Vienne's commission that's happening right now is limited to 6 government sectors and only looks over a 15-year period. Audette says, you know, we're dealing with 500 years of colonialism with the National Inquiry. So as I said before, over 70 people told their stories when the inquiry came to Montreal last week. The testimonies were personal and highly emotional, and many often ran more than 2 hours, with only a short period left for questions from commissioners at the end. The stories told Montreal range from tales of like personal triumph over domestic violence and alcoholism to families sharing stories about their devastation, that they're still devastated over the disappearances of their loved ones. So right now, I would like to share a story, specifically one story that was shared during the public hearings in Montreal. For those who want to watch the public hearings, because like I said, they take place in public and private, but the public ones are all available to watch on the CPAC website if you are interested. So one of the stories told in Montreal, Francois Rupert House, shares stories about her 2 siblings. So Rupert House grew up in the remote Algonquin community of Picagan, which is north of Val-d'Or. In the late 1950s, her two-year-old brother, Tony, was airlifted to a nearby hospital in Amos, Quebec, for a respiratory infection. The family was living in the bush outside of Pickagan at the time, so airlifting was the only option. However, Tony never came home. Rupert House told the inquiry there was no body, no death certificate. They were just simply told, your baby is dead. Rupert House later discovered through medical records that Tony had been transferred to a hospital in Baie St. Paul, where he stayed for more than 5 years before he died at the age of seven. And a year after Tony, Rupert House's sister Emily, who was then five, was taken to the same hospital to be treated for an allergic reaction to a bee sting. She then wasn't seen again for 30 years, until health authorities in Baie St. Paul contacted the health center in Pickagan looking for her family. By the time Emily and her family were reunited, her health had deteriorated and she passed away in 2000. So, it's crazy. Commissioner Michelle Audette said that she's heard similar stories all across the country. And there are cases of Atikamekw children in Quebec's North Shore who were sent to hospital by float plane without their parents, and upon their release, disappeared or were placed with white families without their parents' consent. And some were even declared dead without, you know, just without proof.
Yeah.
Commissioner Audette said this shows a pattern, and this may be linked to the 60s scoop, which was a practice in the 1960s of taking children from their families and placing them in foster homes or adoption and subsequently place in residential schools. I wish I had more time to get into the 60s scoop, but we have a lot of topics to cover. But if anyone listening is interested, definitely, definitely look into the 60s scoop. It was a... yeah, very tied to residential schools. So, yeah, the national inquiry is ongoing now. Like I said, they are now in Manitoba. And very recently, they asked for a two-year extension. They were supposed to compile their report and have it ready by the end of this year, but they are asking for an extension to continue holding more community hearings and have more time to compile.
Thank you so much, Allison, for providing some context with those really powerful and disturbing accounts and stories. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to hear more about responses from within the community and some other high-profile cases currently unfolding that involve Indigenous victims.
CJLO in Concordia University sits on the traditional territory of the Mohawk, or the Ganegahaga people. The island called Montreal is known as Dardake in the language of Ganegaha, and has historically been a meeting place for other Indigenous nations, including the Algonquin people.
You're listening to CJLO 1690 AM.
Le ciel bleu sur nous peut s'effondrer.
Hi, you're listening to Femme AM, Concordia's only feminist radio show on CJLO 1690 AM. Today we are talking about the structural and systemic racism that exists in Canada's treatment of Indigenous people. Before the break, Allison told us a bit about the inquiry that's currently happening in regard to missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. And now we're going to hear from Melanie speaking about the Quebec Native women's response to the inquiry here in Montreal.
Thank you, Megan. So Quebec Native women, the Femmes Autochtones de Québec in French, QNW, I'll refer to them as from now on. They are an organization in Montreal here, founded in 1974 with the aim of defending the interests of Indigenous women, their families, and their communities throughout Quebec. And they have been part of this national inquiry from the start. They played actually a fairly strong role in ensuring that the inquiry took place. In fact, their president has stressed that over the past 30 years, they've been fighting and denouncing these forms of violence against Indigenous women and girls, including 10 years trying to mobilize a legal inquiry. So they're a very, very strong voice in both the national conversation and the conversation here in Montreal. And they came out on Monday with a response to the testimonies that took place this past week in Montreal. And basically, they really wanted to speak out, and they already have in the past spoken out against the system that the inquiry and the structure that the inquiry has taken, and the kind of layout of it. As Allison was mentioning, there's been lots of criticism of that. So QNW has already officially given some of their feedback to the inquiry as early as January. They gave some feedback, asked for a few specific things, a few specific ways that they would like to see the inquiry change and restructure. And so they held this press conference because they did not see that change mm-hmm. after these testimonies last week. So QNW President Viviane Michel was speaking on behalf of the organization, and they had their lawyers present, and they wanted to express concern. Again, as Allison was saying, and as Cassie has said, there's a lack of proof, a lack of evidence being shown in these hearings. That includes police reports, coroner's reports, medical files, all of these things, which ends up putting these witnesses, who are giving very, very personal testimony, in an awkward position during their testimony because they are unable to answer these official questions about documentation that mm-hmm. should exist. In some cases, they might have different information from what the documentation mm-hmm. has shown, and this is because they're not being given that documentation ahead of time. So Viviane really stressed that, you know, we're putting families in a very traumatizing position in having to retell these traumatizing stories to begin with. And so it's really unfair to the families to not be providing them with all this information. So she stressed that from their perspective, it's taking more of a shape of a truth commission rather than a true inquiry. So this press conference was held because these concerns went unanswered. And so, as we mentioned, there's a there is a 2-year extension being looked at right now. So they are wanting to request a suspension of the hearings for now for a period of 5 months in order for the commission to restructure itself. So before it continues with that 2-year extension, they want to see a restructuring take place. They want to see a consultation with Indigenous organizations, and they want to see respect for the governmental decree that allowed for a legal inquiry to take place with subpoena powers. So they want to see all of this documentation come forward because we're seeing this, as Cassie mentioned, that documentation is problematic. There is a lack of it. We don't have all the information, and we need to show that in order to really show what the systemic issues are in this inquiry. So here is a quote from Viviane. She was doing the press release of the press conference in French, so it's a bit of a rough translation. But she says, "We want to see the documents to prove that the legal system does not apply when it comes to the disappearances of Indigenous women. I've been saying since 2012 that Indigenous women are ignored in the judicial process, which leads to an open door for gratuitous violence, because we as Indigenous women become the best targets for these predators and murderers, because there is impunity. So we would like to close that door. We would like for our women and girls to be protected. The judicial system is there to protect citizens, and our women, our sisters, our mothers very much need protecting."
Thank you so much, Melanie. Yeah, QNW is doing such powerful work and is a really great resource for anyone who wants to learn more about these issues. Now we're going to hear from Victoria, who was able to interview Talia Belrose of the Soto First Nation this week.
Hello. So Talia was a very interesting person. She's very involved and is a public speaker for Indigenous women all over. She's been published in newspapers and has been really been vocal about these issues. So in our interview was about a half hour, but I've managed to just, you know, she's talked about her personal experiences. So that's what we're going to mainly focus on today. And it was just very, her honesty is very appreciative and very respected. So without any further ado, here is the clip.
There's been a lot of hostility between Indigenous and non-Indigenous. Being out in Saskatchewan, it is exactly like the Western films. It's Indians and cowboys, and a few minorities in between.
Oh my God.
I actually had an elder that was in Saskatoon this past weekend, and she actually experienced some racism there just walking down the street. She came from a conference called Think Indigenous.
Okay.
And yeah, somebody had rolled by in a truck and started doing a war call, and it was funny the way she reacted. She was like, "Oh, like I brought this on myself," because she was wearing her drum. And okay. she had, like, things that were, I guess, traditionally associated with indigenous people.
So just because of the traditional customs, let's say, I mean, she feels like she... it was her fault that she attracted this.
Yes. And this isn't someone in their 20s. This is someone who's in their 50s, is almost an elder. She isn't quite elderly, but she's an elder here at school, as our guidance counselor.
And, oh, wow.
Just hearing that, I wasn't surprised. It's actually one of the reasons why I moved away from Saskatchewan. I always felt like I was put into a group. Where when I came to Montreal, it was people couldn't figure out my nationality, which was something that was completely new to me, and it was just like a breath of fresh air. It was nice to know that I wasn't in the same category as the stereotypes of Indigenous people in Saskatchewan, who are usually people with like a bunch of kids on welfare, or drunks, or drug users, or prostitutes, or things like that. And it was. Yeah, it was nice.
Yeah, your friend Emma mentioned something like that. She said that yesterday when I interviewed her, she said that there was this one man at one point who was in pain. And you have a different name for police in the reserves? Peacekeepers?
They have peacekeepers.
Okay.
In Saskatchewan, we just have the RCMP.
All right, so it's very different.
Yeah.
And so they thought that just because he was on the sidewalk in pain, they thought he was just drunk, whatever. So it was just very stereotypical even here.
Yeah.
Did you ever feel, I'm sure with what you've just told me right now, but did you personally have an experience where you were walking either in Saskatchewan or here and you felt unsafe?
Probably, but not to an extent where I was terrified or needed to seek immediate attention from somebody else. But yeah, actually, there was a time when I was actually in Montreal. I was outside having a cigarette, and a Native person had approached me. I knew he was First Nations himself, and he asked for a cigarette, so I gave him one, and we sat there and we had a cigarette. But when I was trying to go away, he grabbed me and wanted a hug. So at first I was saying no, like, don't touch me, but then I was like, no, it's just a hug. And then at one point he wouldn't let go,
and so it was more than just affection. It was,
yeah, and it was like on St. Catherine, and I remember kind of raising my voice, but I remember kind of looking around to see if anybody would help me. And nobody. Everybody kind of just was minding staring. Their own business and staring. And I was kind of just taken back by it. And I've actually felt more racism here targeted towards me because mm-hmm. there is, again, a bad representation of Indigenous people. Actually, I don't know if I feel there's more racism here, if there's more racism in Saskatchewan.
Do you feel people are a bit more ignorant here in Montreal? Because like you mentioned, when you first came here, people weren't really sure about what was your real nationality. And do you feel that they just don't know what Indigenous people, I mean, their culture, how they're supposed to look like? They just stereotype you already off the bat.
Yeah. Like, it's really funny what people are willing to say and feel comfortable saying when they don't think that specific group is within their talking group. So I've had a lot of people say racist jokes about Aboriginal people or just really things in bad taste. And a lot of times it's in a position where I don't feel comfortable correcting them because it's usually at a bar or, like, somewhere where it's just, you know what, I'm not gonna fight this.
Choose your battles.
Yeah, exactly.
Perfect. Emma told me, because I met you through Emma.
Yeah.
So Emma told me that you've done some public speaking about this topic. And where exactly did you do it? Did you do it over here? Did you do it in Saskatchewan?
There's actually a very small Indigenous group in here, and just being a year in Montreal, I feel like I've gotten myself into that group,
so
and really
only
well
been
known.
A year. Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
And in Saskatchewan, there's a ton of Native people and a lot of people who are doing really good work. And I just, as soon as I left, I felt like I was just getting my foot into the door, into knowing people. But here, I've been able to speak at the Colton Bushi case. I've been able to speak at the National Gathering for Indigenous Networking for First Voices Week, and then during the walkout at McGill. And then I've been published with the Montreal Gazette and CBC Radio, and just recently the McGill Daily.
That is amazing.
Yeah, So
congratulations. That is amazing. You should feel proud of that. That is amazing. So you mentioned now the walkout at McGill. Since you're a student at Concordia and you follow a few classes at McGill, what exactly happened?
So it was just the following to remind people that we're not going to forget and we're not going to let people forget Colton Boucher and Tina Fontaine and Brady. I can't remember his last name, but he was an Indigenous person on a reserve who was involved in a hit and run, and nobody has been held accountable for his death. And that's just, it's an ongoing issue everywhere in Canada where a lot of Native people are actually blamed for their own death, and that's exactly what it's like for Aboriginal women. It's,
what are the accusations? Like you said, now this woman that was walking down the street felt that, like, she brought this upon herself because she was wearing traditional.
Yeah.
He was as well. You think those are the accusations that are being put on, like...
So when an Aboriginal woman goes missing, it's not a Amber Alert. It's not something that's going to be sent out to the public right away to let the public know. It's either, oh, she either ran away, she's out partying or on a binge, she's gone somewhere. It's something that's always her fault. And it's never taken as seriously, and it's always by the police. And I felt discrimination by the police. I don't trust them, like, whatsoever. I remember when, 4 years ago, I was assaulted by a man in Ottawa. Wow. But I came back to Montreal the next day, and I had, like, my face was beaten. Like, you could see marks across my face and everything. And so I went to the police station, actually, right beside the school on Montreal. Or, no, sorry, St. Catherine. And I thought it would have been a lot smoother than it was, because there was a female cop that was talking to me. And
so you felt as a female she would
have some sympathy or, exactly, like, be able to help or something. And it was... she was completely cold, completely disregarded. She asked me if I was intoxicated.
Wow.
As if it was my fault.
Is that the first stereotype?
It is.
Always brought upon the intoxication?
Yeah.
Okay.
So it was like, well, you were drunk, it was your fault type thing. And I was just dumbfounded by what she said to me. And she was like, well, it happened in Ottawa. You're going to have to go back to Ottawa to go file charges if you want this to be taken.
So very indifferent of what happened to you.
So, yeah, and I was...
no connection.
Yeah, and I was very upset, because I have a friend in Saskatchewan who is actually now a lawyer. And he's the one that pressured me to go to the police. Because I had reached out to him, and I was like, what do I do? Like, I'm obviously in shock, and I'm suffering something. I don't know what is happening. Like, I'm feeling all these emotions that I've never felt before, because I've never been attacked by anybody.
And because of this discouraging situation, you feel like...
I got mad at him, and I got mad at the police, and I got mad at everybody, and it just, you know, I just felt like another statistic, and there was really no help. So it was very frustrating, and I was very let down by the system yet again.
Do you feel like that... well, obviously it discourages women to talk about it, but do you feel like you shouldn't even try anymore?
I think there has to be better resources for people, for women to
use. Definitely.
So I just want to thank Talia again for her honesty and for the time that she gave to discuss about her personal experiences. And she mentioned resources as the Nation of Montreal, for the natives. I mean, there's a bunch of resources that she says that here in Montreal, I mean, they're open for everyone, and it's not just people who are homeless or who have drug or intoxication. I mean, it's for women, it's for even male, anyone who feels they need an aid. They're open here in Montreal, and so I just would like to thank her once more.
Definitely. Well, yeah, thank you very much to you, Victoria, and to Talia as well. We're going to take a short break right now, and when we come back, we're going to talk a bit more specifically about the Tina Fontaine and Colton Boucher cases.
You're listening to CJLO 1690 AM.
Hi, you're listening to Femme AM, Concordia's only feminist radio show on CJLO 1690 AM. Today we are talking about the structural and systemic racism that exists in Canada's treatment of Indigenous people. One issue that came up a lot as we were planning today's episode was the lack of spaces in the community for Indigenous and non-Indigenous people to intermingle and spend time learning from each other. Even in spaces that we assume are that should encourage this kind of discussion. For example, I spoke to Prairie Rose. She's a support worker in Saskatchewan from the Piapo First Nation. I asked her about her experience at the University of Regina, where she studied human justice. We were just discussing kind of I was curious about how the conversation surrounding the Colton Bushi and Tina Fontaine trials would play out in a university context, and she had this to say. From my past experience as a student in justice classes at the University of Regina, I do not think I would have felt comfortable discussing the Stanley case. It would have been very emotional. Often, as one of the only Indigenous students in the classroom, you are the minority, usually like 1 to 10 students, maybe even higher. When you do discuss issues like this, it's almost as if the other students and even professors take your experiences and opinions to be representative of all Indigenous people, which is impossible. My thoughts, opinions, and experiences are my own. In previous classes, when hot topic Indigenous issues came up, they would often leave me feeling angry to the point of rage sometimes. They would give me anxiety. I did speak up through my time in university, but it was often very hard. Academia is not a safe place for Indigenous people to have these conversations when they are the minority. I mean, this, just that last sentence really hit me powerfully. Prairie was also very careful and conscientious to point out that she did have professors that she felt she could trust in, like, throughout her degree, and that there was, like, people who tried to approach her outside of class to kind of foster a more productive conversation around these things, but that really, as an institution, universities are still not, like, doing enough to kind of address these issues and provide safe spaces. That being said, there are students and people who are taking it upon themselves to kind of fill in these gaps and that are doing really important and ambitious work in order to address this lack of discussion. Earlier this week, I had the pleasure of speaking with Leslie St. Armour, an Indigenous law student at the University of Toronto. Last week, Leslie and some of her colleagues organized a walkout and teach-in to raise awareness and open up a dialogue in the wake of the Colton Bushi and Tina Fontaine cases. It was part of a larger initiative by several law schools across Canada to address these controversial cases.
My name is Leslie Ann Saintamore. I'm a member of the Bonacher Algonquin First Nation. I'm a law student at U of T and a member of the Indigenous Law Students Association. We decided to hold it at the day we did because we wanted it to be a little bit outside of what we estimated to be kind of the general news cycle for this issue, because we wanted to ensure it stayed within the news and kind of stayed at the forefront of people's minds and ensured that people watching knew that even when this dropped out of the media, we were still working. We were still actively involved and this was still in our minds.
Yeah.
And kind of what we wanted to do with it is, our event was a little bit different than some of the other schools. We did a walkout and a teach-in where we talked about some of the systemic issues that are outside of the legal system but impacted the application of the legal system in these cases, as well as more generally for it, how they impact Indigenous people's experiences with the legal system more generally. Mm-hmm. And that was because we wanted to ensure that our peers, as law students, as future lawyers, as future policymakers, understood these intersecting systems that aren't necessarily taught inside the classroom.
So as you heard, Leslie and her colleagues wanted to do something to ensure that other law students understood that there was more than just a legal question in these cases and understand that other systems are at work and that contributed to the acquittal in both of the cases of the accused here. Another thing Leslie mentioned was that, you know, law curriculums are already like so content heavy and that it's just really hard for professors to carve out the space in order to address these issues.
I think it is important that these issues are discussed and finding ways to be able to do that. So our Indigenous Law Students Association, we held a panel with a professor and a practicing lawyer and an elder a couple weeks before, speaking specifically about the Stanley case, as well as holding the walkout to discuss both the Stanley case and the Cromier case. So Colton Bushi and Tina Fontaine more largely, and focusing less specifically on the purely legal issues. But okay. It is hard, I think, for professors to sometimes find appropriate ways to bring these kind of messier cases into the classroom in a way that makes sense for them. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, but I would like to see them do more. I don't think that's an excuse, but I can understand why it doesn't happen as often as we would like.
In relation to this, I also asked Leslie about the disconnect that exists in between Indigenous and minority communities and how problematic this is. We discussed the fact that in some ways political correctness can actually be a bit stifling around this topic because the literacy around Indigenous issues remains so low and our standard Canadian education system just doesn't really address it. I asked her if she thought fear of saying the wrong thing factors into the relative silence about these topics in non-Indigenous communities.
Absolutely. And I made a big point of that when we held the teach-in, actually, to say to students who were there that, you know, I don't care if you are afraid of asking me the question the wrong way. I don't care if you don't know the right terms to use, but I'd rather people ask and talk about it and so that they don't walk away not knowing. They don't walk away with gaps in their knowledge that might impact, for example, in our context, Indigenous clients they work with one day. Because I'd rather they take the time and ask and learn. And there are so many ways to do that, but I do also appreciate that there's a lot of moments of silence when I ask those questions. And I think a little bit of that is folks not necessarily having questions, but also not knowing what to ask, is not knowing what they don't know.
Definitely this issue of not knowing what you don't know is crucial. I spoke with Leslie about some of the key issues they addressed in the teach-in at the U of T. So things that her and her colleagues had identified as some of like the key problems that they wanted other students and people in the community to be aware of. And I also asked her what she feels are some of the structural problems of how Indigenous issues are dealt with.
One of the big ones for us was looking at Tina Fontaine, her last several days in the various government agencies and actors she interacted with who should have been able to help and support her but weren't. So when she interacted with the police the day before, when there was a missing persons alert out for her and they didn't catch that, they released her. The doctor she saw at the hospital who was worried she was being sexually exploited but had to release her into the care of Child and Family Services because there was no ability for them to keep her longer. And Child and Family Services, whose care she was in, who, due to their regulations and their circumstance, left her in at the hotel but couldn't force her to stay when she said she was leaving. Mm-hmm. And looking at the fact that there are such high numbers of children in care and how that can be a problematic system and how Indigenous people are often blamed for the circumstances of their children then being taken into care, but even in care, these children aren't being protected. And trying to understand that it's not only the legal system that failed Tina, but all of these, the healthcare system, the justice system, looking at the police and the child welfare system that failed her in this case. And understanding that we can't only look at one when trying to ensure there's no more cases like Tina's, but we have to look at all of them. And looking at Colton Bushy's case, one of the things we talked about is how the stereotypes and ideas people have about Indigenous people that played in this case, particularly within commentary about he had the right to protect his property, they were trespassing, things like that, even though that wasn't the case legally. And looking at, you know, how people portrayed Colton and how people viewed him. And I gave the example of how, as law students and as university students, many of my friends and I have been told that the only reason we got into university, the only reason we got into law school is because we're Indigenous, and how that basically saying that an Indigenous person isn't capable of getting into university on their own merit, it's only through other systems. And I gave the example of how that perpetuates the same kind of stereotypes and ideas as those that were at play in Colton Bushy's case, just to a less drastic degree, but wanting people to understand that these systems exist around all of us, whether they play out in such drastic ways or in such and much more subtle ways as they do in the experiences of many of the students at the school.
So as you can hear, definitely a lot needs to change if we are going to work towards resolving some of these very crippling systematic issues that exist. As mentioned before, I think we feel that active, sensitive listening is one of the most important things we can do. I also posed the question to Prairie Rose, who I quoted earlier, about what non-Indigenous allies and accomplices can do, especially in a university setting, to support the Indigenous community as it continues to take action against these injustices. She said, "I think for Indigenous issues to be expressed safely in a campus setting, it needs to be made a safe place for Indigenous students to express themselves. I've seen debates get very heated with no real intervention from professors. I've also encountered professors that were great at this. I think that hate speech, posts, comments, etc. should be punished to the fullest extent, so people learn to converse constructively and not just out of anger. They need to learn to hear both sides and listen respectfully even when they disagree." So as you can hear, and as we've tried to iterate several times throughout this, and as the whole inquiry into the missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls is attempting to do and hopefully will improve their ability to do in the future, we just really need to listen to these stories and try to understand them the best we can, even if we're coming from a different cultural place or perspective, and not to be afraid to address them and to ask questions and to take it upon ourselves to become more educated about what's going on and about how the systems, the legal systems, the health systems, all of the government operative systems in Canada are working to oppress Indigenous people. We will definitely post with the show notes today some resources that you can check out to learn more about these things.
The one resource that I wanted to say before was the Native Women's Shelter of Montreal, which is an amazing shelter and amazing resource for women who don't feel, as my interview with Talia was, that they felt no help from the police. I mean, those resources are there for that reason. I want to say also, as an addition to what Megan was saying, is when I first sat down with Talia, I met Talia through my friend Emma, which is why Emma's name was a bit mentioned before. Shout out to Emma. when I first sat down with both of them, I mean, I never made it. I mean, I could say that when I said ignorant for people who in Montreal, is not that we're ignorant, but like we need to listen a bit more. And I felt that it was okay. When I sat down, they really made me feel comfortable in saying that it's okay that I did not know as much as I should have known, and that it was not primarily our fault because the system has it that we do not know so much. And the fact that we are taking it upon us to educate ourselves is a great first step. I mean, that's how resources are being built, support groups, and just them being more comfortable and talk about these matters and not feeling that they shouldn't be speaking up with or being vocal either at school, teachers or other friends or people at bars, and that they could feel safe. So I felt that was really important.
Definitely. And so again, a really special thanks to Talia, to Prairie, and to Leslie, all who really generously gave their time in interviewing with us for this episode and in teaching us more about the dialogue within the community. And we're really, really grateful to
them. Very grateful.
Yeah, and I think like another thing that we should be mindful of and you know, feel really grateful that we had that opportunity today was to bring Indigenous voices to the forefront. And I think this is something that we hear in journalism school, and I've heard from people on internships who have done work with Indigenous pieces, but yet they're lacking Indigenous voices.
For sure.
And I know when we were organizing the show, that was something we made a priority, was like getting the Indigenous voices to the forefront, because even on like a reporting level, there are not many Indigenous reporters at, let's say, like a big company like CBC or even at like Global News. We do have like the Eastern Door, which is on the Kanawaki Reserve. I do believe, correct me if I'm wrong.
No, it is.
And, you know, getting those stories out. And so, you know, looking back at that data and now that it's coming forward, you know, going back to that foundation, it does provide some eye-opening statistics that we can't hide behind anymore. And if you need the numbers to prove the stories, then, you know, let's bring those voices with those numbers.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so thank you all so much for tuning in to today's episode of Femme AM. Thank you to everyone for their hard work on this show. And
big thanks.
Yeah, really. This is such an important topic. And as I said, please like take the initiative to continue educating yourself about it. There are lots of really great resources out there from people working really, really hard in the community to try to elucidate some of these issues and present them more clearly for us. So, yeah, thank you again. And we'll be here again next week. So
yes, bye.
Until then, bye.